canonization of Tanakh, and the Mesorah, how the Mesorah has come down to us. Right? That the Mesorah part included everything from Kriyuksiv, how the dots come in, how the Tameh HaMikra, Yeshem HaMikra, Yeshem HaMesorah, Mesorah Katana, Mesorah Gedola, how the words have come down to us. Right? Okay. Okay. Then we did Targumim, translations, the Greek, and we limited ourselves to Greek and Aramaic. Then we did ancient Near East. Okay. Then we did ancient Parshanut. Parshanut included Philo of Alexandria, the Dead Sea Scrolls, Josephus, these pre-Chazal sources have a lot to say about how they read Tanakh. Right? Okay. The quiz that I will be giving you, I think it's a week from today, right?
Yeah.
Everyone see? Everyone here? A week from today is going to be on what we call Parshanut. This course used to be called Biblical Exegesis. An exegete is a Parshan. Okay, book is the Foresh, the Pasuk. Okay? Alright, means that we're starting with our question of how Pshat developed. Why, after studying the Tanakh for 1,000 years, mostly with Drash, all of a sudden someone says, "Hey, let's do Pshat." What happened? Remember that we talked about that—a Christian influence on the outside or an internal influence? Okay, Pshat, Drash, the meaning of Mashma, Mashmaut, the meaning of the words. How does Rashi and Ibn Ezra understand Al-Dvar Sarai Eishes Avram? Paro was stricken Al-Dvar Sarai Eishes Avram. Here is an exercise for a possible question early on in the exam. Paro was stricken Al-Dvar Sarai Eishes Avram. So, if you are a strict, close reader of Mashmaut, right, you're going to ask, why does the Torah use Al-Dvar? It should say that Paro was stricken Bishvil, Bavur, Odot, Biglal. There are many more easier one words to use than an idiom. Get it? Okay. I hope by now everybody in this room can answer this in the middle of the night, that it's a Rashi kind of perush that's going to be such a close reader as to say, this is why the Torah uses Al-Dvar to teach, Paro was stricken by the word of Sarai, Eishes Avram. Okay? You hear it? Okay. Ibn Ezra says these two words mean
beauty.
What? Al-Dvar Sarai Eishes Avram. Vayinaga Hashem es Paro Al-Dvar Sarai Eishes Avram. What does Al-Dvar mean?
On the matter.
Right. Now, on the matter is the exact mashma'ut of those words. Right? You may want to idiomatically simplify that by translating it. I'm curious to see how Art Scrolls translates that. Right? Well, how would you just put that into a much easier English? God afflicted Paro.
Guarding?
Is that what you would say in English? Just say your simplest English if you're just talking. Go ahead. God afflicted Paro.
Because of
sorrow. All right? I don't know if you'd say regarding Sarah. You might not say it that way. Okay.
Okay, so Al Dvar Sarai Ishes Avram, the English here reads, because of the matter of Sarai, he went overboard. Because of would have been enough. On the matter of would have been enough, but he does both. Okay. If I may give you an English translation like that and say, whose translation does this fit more with the approach that they take to the Torah? Rashi or Ibn Ezra? Show me that you know that. Okay? Or Rashi or Rashbam. Got it? Okay? If you can correctly diagnose, if you will, the difference between the way Rashi reads and the way the strict Pashtunim reads, then you're going to know how Rabbi Akiva works and how Rabbi Yishmael works. And if you're really astute, you'll figure this out between Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Abaye and a host of machloikis in Shas, between typical Bar Pluktas, where one tends to read the text like Rashi, where everything has to be nitpicked and darshaned, and one says stands from a distance. Okay? If you recall, I divided Rashi's four ages into drash, significance. Right? Text must have significance. Text shouldn't be contradictory. Now, on this one, everybody agrees with that. Everybody agrees the text shouldn't be contradictory, right? The question is, if Rashi allows for contradictions more readily than others. And we gave some examples of this, right? Rashi says that Vayikach me'avnei hamakom contradicts Vayikach esha even asher sam mirashi sav, right? Because the bottom line speaks of one stone. The top line seems to speak of many stones. So, to Rashi, that's a contradiction that needs to be resolved. Got it? This is probably a good mussar in life in general. The best way to resolve a problem is to show first that there is no problem. Rashbam looks at this. It's actually a Tosfos on the Gemara in Chulin that brings out this whole thing that needs to be resolved in a way that only a five-year-old can accept in reality, right? It's interesting that the Medrash Rabbah has three or four explanations of how many stones become one, but you only know the one that Rashi mentions, which is that they fought to be under Yaakov's head, right? Now, a five-year-old gets a message from that and goes, you know what? It's good to try to get close to a good person, you know, a good person. If you remember, Steinman passed away this morning. In B'nai Brak, I don't know if he was 103 years old. He wrote a Haskama, one of my sparring. So now if I do another, Lefkowitz also wrote a Haskama for me, and I had to, my first edition, he was alive. The second edition, he had passed away, so I had to change Shlita to Zal. Anyway, so get close. You should one time in your life meet someone like that if you can. Right? Okay. So Rav Chaim Kanievsky, who's still alive, Baruch Hashem, he wrote a nice Haskama for me also, the same Sefer, and I have a big picture of him, and he's like smiling, looking at the Sefer. I showed him some of the commentaries. It's actually that Sefer right there, the Mishlei on Rukeya. And so I had one of my students, my mom, teacher of mine also, was over the my house, and he plays guitar. He's a comedian, very talented guitar player. 17, really talented. So he says, "Who's that guy?" Right? In the picture. So I said, "Let me tell you something. If you made up a song and you had Bruce Springsteen or Billy Joel looking over your music and smiling and saying, that's good stuff, right? That's who this guy is." Okay? But you don't know it. Okay, Rav Chaim Kanievsky is the Rav Moshe Feinstein of the current time now. Right? He lives in Israel, he's not in America. But Rav Moshe Feinstein has not been replaced here in America, but that's who he is, Rav Chaim Kanievsky. It's the Stipe Gaon's son. And Rav Yashiv's son-in-law.
So I'm just mentioning this now because of the rocks. The rocks said, let's get close to Rashi. Why did I get off on this 2-minute tangent right now? To try to explain to you why Rashi puts that in his Beirush. This is Nechama Leibowitz, and this is the last Lubavitcher Rebbe. I don't know if it's going to be another one, but the last Lubavitcher Rebbe passed away about 20 years ago. He says that Rashi purposely puts into his Beirush commentaries that are meant to be mechanech. So when you're 5 years old and you read it for the first time, and then you're 45 years old and you say, Rashi, really? Rocks fighting? Right? So you get to see it in different ways. Rocks fighting is just to tell you that the Torah purposely wrote this in a way to get the reader to feel, no, I'm going to get close to a tzaddik. I'm going to meet a tzaddik. Right? So good. Okay? Right? If you go to his house in Rehov, he lives on Rehov Rashbam. I love it. In Bnei Brak. And you go up to his house, you see, especially when his wife was alive. She was the real rock star. There is a line going around, down here, this big like fire escape getting into his house. Down the fire escape, down the block, sometimes around the corner. Just to have 10 seconds. I don't know where he has time to do all that he does. He writes Sfarim, he goes to Shas, a number of Mefarshim, Shas Babi, Yerushalmi, the whole Shulchan Aruch, the whole Rambam, and the whole Medrash Rabbah every year. And he makes a Siyam on all of that every Erev Pesach. And he has people just lining up just to have one moment just for him to say, Bracha Vatzlacha, next, Bracha Vatzlacha. It's amazing. So that's why Rashi wrote this thing about the rocks. It sounds implausible, unbelievable. Who could think of such a thing? And that's why Ibn Ezra ridiculed such a thing. I'm telling you all this because I think if Rashi was sitting here and you asked him, Rashi, did the rocks really fight under Yaakov? He goes, no, but he caught me. He took one of the stones. Right? Okay. Maybe, I don't know. I can't be for sure. Because it says afterwards, by Yosem, I told you this in class, Mirash of Sav, which seems to imply around his head, not under his head. Okay? Alright, so when it comes to contradictions, what commentary isn't going to be concerned with what appears to be contradictory in the Torah? Hashem tells Avram, your descendants will be in Egypt for 400 years, and when we left, it says we were in Egypt 430 years. And there's a tradition that we were only there 210 years. Everybody's got to deal with that. You got it? Whether you're Rashi or Rashbam, okay? Another thing is Rashi cares very much about Mashmaut, close reading, right? And the homily. Meaning, that's really the secret weapon of Rashi. Not that Rashbam and Ibn Ezra don't think there are homilies in the Torah, but they don't get into my Perush unless it is significantly the Pshat. Right? I'm not here at the Darshan. Ibn Ezra likes every drash that Rashi brings out because they're mostly sourced in Bereishis Rabbah, and Ibn Ezra read Bereishis Rabbah as well as anybody. He just says Bereishis Rabbah does not influence my Perush like it influences Rashi's Perush. Okay? I think every Jew should read Bereishis. He says that all over. Rashbam says it too. Every Jew should be reading every Medrash. But understand, that's for Shalosh Shunas Torah. This is a Perush that's sticking to Pshat. Right? Rashbam said it even at the expense of Halacha sometimes. Okay? Good? So this is little quiz you're getting a week from today, right, is going to be on the Parshanim. Okay, start with Rashi, of course. Go to Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, Ramban. Right? Again, why Pshat? What is Pshat? Now remember, we did this pretty early in the semester about Christian influence. Be prepared from our notes on this, of how a particular pasuk, even if you can do Hinema Alma Harabi, let it bend, the virgin that's giving birth. Right? The three objections a Jew might have to this pasuk referenced to Jesus are the three foundations of Pshat. Right? Philology, grammar and context. Okay? You lose on philology, Alma doesn't mean Basula. And we're not talking here about whether a virgin can give birth or not. That's okay. Surely reality has to be in here, right? I would say, you know, first and foremost. Okay? But we believe in miracles. I mean, there are some things that Moshe lifts up his hand and the sea splits, you know. Right? It's not like the movie. The splitting of the Red Sea happened over a period of time. Right? Ben Ezra makes a big deal about this. Okay? You know, it still happens in a way that could be construed as a natural event. I think the movie was Moses, Prince of Egypt? No, there was a movie made about 2 or 3 years
Exodus.
Ago.
Exodus?
It was called Exodus? Christian Bale, I think.
Yeah.
There's a scene where the wind blows over the whole night and the water starts receding slowly. It's not like the movie The Ten Commandments, where Moshe says, "Behold the power of the Lord," and everything splits in a second. No! It says in the Torah, "Kol ha'layla, ruach kodim," the eastern wind, just slowly over the whole night, spreading the water out. Right? So stuff like that has happened. So this is Ibn Ezra's, you know, Ibn Ezra likes to downplay miracles. He wants to show that every miracle, even the mon, is something that can happen within the framework of the natural order. The miracle is that it happened when we needed it to happen. Okay, so obviously it has to be reality. You can't, pshat has to fit reality. Right? That, remember what Rashbam calls that? Please, someone make my day. Okay, Derech Eretz. Okay. He says it's not Derech Eretz that the girl helping Avraham's servant in the beginning of in Parshas Chayisara is 3. It's also not Derech Eretz that the guy taken up to a mountain with his father, right, to be slaughtered as an interpretation of Aleihu La'olah, right, is 37. He disagrees harshly with Rashi on both those scores. Okay. Because it's not Derech Eretz. You don't mean Derech Eretz like we heard Derech Eretz called in the Torah. It's a different thing. Derech Eretz means 5 or 6 different things in Chazal. Okay? The first time the words appear in the Torah, right, is when Lot's daughters think that there are no more men for them to have children with. Derech Kol Ha'aretz. So we better repopulate the world with our father. Right? The Derech Eretz of the world is that a woman does not have a child with her father. They'll go out and marry someone else. But they didn't have that Derech Eretz. Because they thought the whole world was destroyed except the 3 of them. Right? Okay? So Derech Eretz means just the way things are. Get it? Rashbam used the Torah terminology in that story to say, it's not Derech Eretz to say that's a 3-year-old and that's, I don't accept. Right? And he doesn't care what medrash she's stepping on, or Rashi, or his father, grandfather he's stepping on when he says that. All right, got it? So it has to be reality to the story. Virgins don't give birth, right? But you know, Rashbam doesn't disagree with miracles. If God wants a virgin to give birth, he'll do it. All right? It's something. This is Mark Chagiga and Dafi Dalad on the base that says, "Can a pregnant virgin marry the Kohen Gadol?" Mara says, how did she get pregnant? The answer to that question is what every halachist has discussed since the late 40s and early 50s when artificial insemination became a thing. Right? Right? Is someone who was inseminated still a virgin? She never had to deal with a man? So the Gemara discusses this. I'm just telling you. You want to say a virgin gave birth because that's what God wants to happen? I'm with that program. I can live with that. But don't tell me that this is a reference to that because it's not. Okay? You got it? That's philology. Philology means what does the word mean, for goodness sakes? And the grammar. She is pregnant. The whole point of this is Hinei ha'alma harabi let it bend. Behold.
Please, someone tell me that you remember what's the purpose of this sign. Remember? Yeah?
To look through someone else's eyes.
The purpose of this sign is for the king not to make a peace pact with the Arameans and the northern kingdom, but to have faith in God against the greater power, Ashur, because Hineha al-Maharabi al-Enifet, and this son will save you. That should be interpreted as a reference to Jesus 600 years later with the Romans, has driven a number of Christians that I know, because I converted them, to be Jewish. They said, what? The virgin birth is based on this? And they have a Bible with them, the King James. Oh my goodness, it says right here, Isaiah 7:14, this is the virgin birth. And after just looking at it from the eyes of a Pashtun, it drove them away. Especially when you look at the other four places where Alma appears in the Tanakh. Alma means young maiden. In the King James Bible. Right? Being sold a bill of goods here. Right? Okay, so when Jews started to get into this, I mean, Hineh, for goodness sakes, means this thing is happening now. Behold, 600 years from now, a Jewish woman is going to give birth as a virgin, and he's going to save you from the Assyrians. Oops. He didn't even save us from the Romans. One time a Jew, while making the argument, squeaked that out, and they killed him on the spot for saying it. Blasphemous. Right. How could this be Jesus? He didn't save us. The Romans had their way with him. Alright? So who's the son of this man? Anybody know? Who's this man? This man is Ochoz. His son Chizkiyahu, who did save us from the Assyrians. Crazy. Alright, so that's the context. How was Ochoz supposed to be assured of his current situation with the Assyrians and the geopolitical order with the Arameans and the northern tribes, right? Because 600 years from now, someone's going to save us from the Romans, which he didn't do. Okay, so you get the point? This kind of forced Bible scholarship, if you will, got the Jews to think, you know what? Reality? Context, grammar, philology, right? Okay. So these are the pillars of Pshat. So you have Rashi, Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, Rabban. Okay. We have the development of Mikros Gedolos, right? You got you all with me on that? And then, to close things out, because we have today, rest of today, Thursday, I'm going to give you some review. Okay, I'm going to give you out something that I am. These are all commentaries we have done in class. Right, it would serve you well to answer them. Answering all of this is it's a lot. Will go a long way towards excelling on what we'll do on next Thursday. Okay. Now, just a final word today to close out today's class on the derech of the Achronim. The Achronim have a different kind of agenda. The world has drastically changed since the time of the Rishonim. We say the Rishonim go until really the Chasima where Shulchan Aruch is written. Probably there's a devastating cataclysmic event that made this is the end of the Rishonim, is the Spanish Inquisition. Right? The Sephardim until then were really, really the main purveyors of Psak, Parshanut. It's just amazing how that has just dipped from there on. Okay. It dips really the greatest 20 Sephardim since from 1500 to 2000. You know, in the I don't want to digress there. So during the next
300 years, let's say till about, let's say 250 years. The only additions noteworthy to the Kurs Gadol, as I told you, was the Kli Yakar and the Or HaChaim. Most commentaries are turning towards Kabbalah, homiletics. Where's the room for Pshat? We have our Pashtunim already, right? Okay, we talked about those two already. But what happens in let's say the year 1800, Parshanut starts again to really cook up, and I would tell you it's largely reactionary. If in the year 1000 Parshanut was reactionary to the Christian dialogue, to the Christian disputation, please show me that you're thinking here, what's happening in 1800 that makes the Ksava Kabbalah, the Vilna Gaon, the Malbim, the Nitziv, the Meshech Chochma, who basically have, I'll get to Shimshon and Paul Hirsch in a minute, who basically have a very similar agenda to show that there is an there is an incontrovertible connection between Torah Shabbat Tzav with Torah Shabbat Peh. Got it? You cannot at all understand the Torah Shabbat Tzav without first being adept at the Torah Shabbat Peh's interpretations. This is what made the Malbim print his Mikros Gedolos, his Peirush, with the Medrashei Halacha, right? The Mechilta, the Sifrat, the Yikra, the Sifrei, the Bamid Ben Barim. Right? There's no Medrash Halacha to Bereishis, as you know, because there's no Halacha in Bereishis. Right? You have lots of Medrash Agada in Bereishis, but no Medrash Halacha. So he's printed, you need a quotation of the Mechilta, and you don't have time to go up and look where is the Mechilta in the base of Medrash, just get the Malbim's Perush. The fifth floor you'll find one, you know, copies of the Mechilta. Right? Okay? Mechilta is the Medrash Halacha to Shmos. Right? Rashi, for instance, uses the Sifrei very liberally in Devarim, but doesn't use the Mechilta too much to Shmos. So it's a question, he had more material in Shmos to use besides Devarim. He didn't have so much. He chose to use just a significant amount of Sifrei in Devarim. Anyway, so the Torah Tmima, but that was much later, wrote his commentary with all the Gemaras about the Psukim. Right, Tol Basaro just mentions it. Right? Just mentions the Gemara. The Torah Tmima quotes the Gemara and gives you the Gemara and his interpretation of the Gemara and what the Gemara saw in the Pasuk to say what it says. Amazing work. Hopefully you got it. At least the one or two Torah Tmima spirit by mitzvah. Right? So this was meant to show an incontrovertible connection between the Torah Shebich Sav and the Torah Shebal Peh. Why is that happening? What? Shabbat Tzvi is 1666, but Shabbat Tzvi is what led to the Or HaChaim and Kli Yakar. But okay, let's say something. What's in the 1800? What's beginning to Germany, especially Germany?
They're becoming very assimilated and very
correct. Critical. Assimilation and the Reform movement. Okay, the Reform movement in some places in Germany became so just. Some just went off the rails. One community wanted to keep Wednesday as the God's day of rest. Others had a minion on Sunday, right? Not Shabbos, but Sunday, like the Christians. We need to. They believed in a Judaism, a Jewish vision for the future, as this is laid out by Yeshayahu. They didn't believe Moshe was an historical figure. They didn't believe Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were. They didn't believe in Matan Torah or Yetzias Mitzrayim. They only believed what you could prove scientifically, right? You hear this terminology in German, Wissenschaft des Judentums, the academic study of Judaism. Judaism has to be studied like any other academic topic, and what can be proved academically, we'll accept. If it cannot be proved, if you cannot prove that Avram walked the earth, you don't accept. Of course, since the time of this movement of reform, a lot of archaeological data has... I'm not looking for proof. I can't prove to you that I'm here talking to you. I'm going to prove to you from an archaeological find something about the conquest of Canaan. We're looking for... Give me a better word than proof. We're looking for... Any lawyers here? What?
Evidence.
Evidence, of course. We're looking for evidence. All right? You know, I've told you this earlier semester. How do I know Yetzias Mitzrayim happened? You want to know how it happened? The same way I know the ovens in Auschwitz happened. You know what that is? My father told me. Okay? And he's not a liar. Right? Now, his father didn't make it out. So his father probably could tell me that too, but his father told him about Yetzias Mitzrayim. And so did his father. Right? Why did it take to the 19th century for someone to say it's a hoax? I hear it because there's people all around started, Christians also started to think more critically, and right, you know what I'm saying? So came some very brilliant commentaries in the midst of all this and said, you know, we have to react to this. There are those who were saying that everything in Bereishis and Shmos, the whole Torah, so I have to show that you know, Jews stay away from this kind of stuff. Right? No one does this better than Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. Right? You've heard of the name? There's a school just a few blocks down named after him. It's called, well, now they call it Breuer's, but right, the community here in Washington Heights, you know, when the war came, there were two German communities. Right? One was led by Rav Breuer, and one was led by someone named Rav Hoffman, Yaakov Hoffman. And they both came to America at the same time. Rav Breuer chose to move to Washington Heights. Rav Hoffman moved to the west side. And the Germans flocked to those two communities to be with the rabbi that they remember from Frankfurt. And I'm so sure you that some smaller rabbis from Hamburg and other places in Berlin came to various places in America. And there was one I know set up shop in Kingsbridge Heights in the Bronx. I happen to have lived in all these neighborhoods at various times. So the rabbis living in these places had to present a Judaism to their members who still remained Orthodox, right? But were very highly influenced by the outside world. This is the beginning of what we call neo-Orthodoxy, or what we might call today modern Orthodoxy, right? Okay? Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, very interesting, because no one looks today as Breuer's, if you know the community here, right? Do you? I don't know. Anybody grew up here? I went to school, I didn't go to Breuer's. I went to the school up here, you know, Sheep Salvation, which was closer up here, which was considered the more centrist kind of place to go to, right? But no one would consider Breuer's today to be the modern Orthodox place. It's all a matter of context, right? Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, his Perush to the Torah, I'm not sure if you could call it Parshanut. It's meant to be and it's so much, every page drips with, you can see, if you know your history of 19th century Germany, he was born in 1808, if you know your history of 19th century Germany, you know he's responding to the ridicule, if you will, the ridicule that the German Jews, the German academic Jews, were visiting upon the biblical text. Right? Okay. I would like to give you some examples. Right? Torah says that there is a very ritualistic purification of the leper. Right? You have to do things with birds and blood and animals and carbonos and they got the quarantine. There's probably a very contagion involved, but the actual purification involves putting blood on the thumb, blood on the big toe, and blood on the right earlobe. Right. For them, this was the same as keeping kosher. Keeping kosher is ridiculously ritualistic, right? And purification of the leper is ridiculously ritualistic. And it's keeping us apart from our neighbors. It's keeping us apart from Tikkun Olam. It's keeping us apart from making this a better world. And it was a historical mistake then, and it's an historical mistake now. It was maybe needed then for health purposes, but remember, this is even before refrigeration or anything. But this milk and meat stuff, it's nonsense, right? In the first Reform graduation in the United States of the Reform, the first Reform Rabbinic Academy, they had their graduation in Cincinnati. That's where the first Reform movement in America flourished. And they invited all whatever rabbis were in America at the time. It was not so many Jews yet. It was before 1881 influx of immigration. This is, I believe it's 1870. I'm sure my son can give the exact date. He's a history major. So 1870s, somewhere around there. And the first graduation, smicha, from this place, the rabbis with their gowns and everything, they only served unkosher food. There wasn't even a kosher food available. They only served shellfish, pork, bacon, ham. They only served that. And what was born in that smicha convocation was the conservative movement in America. A lot of the rabbis who came who said, this is a good thing. Judaism needs to be reformed. But they said, you've gone too far. Right? You get it? Conserve. We have to conserve. Right? And they came very close to orthodoxy, just that they had mixed pews, men and women davening together. Right? They were basically halachic in nature, to the point that even 40 years later, YU was this close to merging with Jewish Theological Seminary. Right? During difficult times in the 20s, where they both were suffering monetarily, and they thought, you know, let's merge. Right? Anyway. So Shimshon Raphael Hirsch sees this and many, many other ridiculing of the Torah in Germany at the time. Right? They ridicule the stories of Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. What Ramban does, where he's critical of the Avos at times, you should see what comes out of the commentaries of these Reform movements. These, you know, Reform commentaries, so to say. Right? Since Avraham never lived, and we're not praying Elokei Abraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov anymore. But the Reform Siddurim did mention Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. They do. But they added Sar, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. So, all right. But of course, they had music. Who said that music is forbidden in a synagogue, and they had music on Shabbos, of course. So let me tell you what Shimshon Raphael Hirsch does with this thumb. Blood on the thumb, blood on the toe, blood on the... So first he goes about to prove incontrovertibly through the Tanakh, and he goes story after story, you can't doubt that that's the Tanakh's point, is that leprosy is a sin that is very revealing. It's on your skin, right? It reveals something about you that has to be checked. It could be on a part of your body that you're not so comfortable having checked, but you gotta show it. You know what? Because... And they show incontrovertibly, as I say again, with Miriam, with Moshe, with Sefer Melachim Beis, and all over Tanakh, that you get to have, you have to be revealed because you tried to reveal something about someone else. It's not such a physical malady, it's more of a spiritual malady. Even, by the way, Rashbam and Ibn Ezra in their commentaries say so. Even the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah, Chutzara, says so. That it's more than just contagion of a skin disorder. Right? And what you did was you revealed something about someone else. Right? Think of Miriam, because God always makes a punishment fit the crime. When you're a parent and you got to punish a child, don't just punish to get off steam. Make sure the punishment is educational. It's rehabilitative. Miriam's, at least in the Pshat, remember we did that with Rashbam, spoke about the skin color of someone. So the punishment she received... Yes, it's tzaras, but it's quite specific, because tzaras not just affects your skin, it changes its color. Get it? So Shimshon Raphael Hirsch brings in all of this, and he says, why dafka does the blood go on the thumb, the big toe, and the earlobe? On the face of it, it looks so outrageously ritualistic and nonsensical. Right? But look what Shimshon Raphael Hirsch does with it. He says, you know what you have, human being? You have the ability of dialogue, of speech. God gave you that to make you different than animals. And what did you do? You spoke about another person. An animal can't do that. An animal doesn't get to speak Lashon Hara. Right? But you do. I've given you a lips and a tongue and a mouth to speak prayer, to speak teaching, to teach good things, to say good things. Right? Gemara compares speaking Lashon Hara to a fly. Why? Because a fly can come into this room and it could be the best foods in the room. But leave a pile of excrement in the corner, that's where the flies go. You know what I'm saying? If you have a scab, that's where the fly is going to land. The fly chooses the worst possible thing to go to. That's what the Lashon Hara is doing with his mouth. So you know what I'm going to put? You shed blood. So you know what I'm going to put blood? On the parts of your body that no animal has. Which is your thumb and your big toe. Just very few have five digits.
Four. Right? Okay? You have five. I let you have that extra digit to show how different you are than animals. And that not any more than your mouth. Now, I should really put the blood on your mouth, but I can't because blood's not kosher. I told you that someplace else. So where am I going to put the blood in addition to those two places? Not on the thing that spoke the Lashon Hara, but on the thing that heard the Lashon Hara. Right? Amazing. All of a sudden it becomes, this was barbaric. It's the Torah's way of telling you that speaking Lashon Hara is barbaric. And this way he got the upper hand on the detractors who were ripping out the pages of Torah all over the place. They loved the passages. Their rabbis gave sermons on the weekly portion, although they stopped reading the weekly portion every week. They read the Torah every 3 years, going back to what they said was the original tradition. True, in Israel they read it every 3 years, but they read it straight. To this day, the Reform movement reads the Torah. They're going to read Parshas Miketz this week, right? But only a third of it. They have a three-year cycle. You get it? They read the first third. I don't know what year this is, but they read the first third of Vayigash, the first third of Vayikra, the first third of Shemot. And then the next year, it's the second third of Vayikra, right? Okay, so they do read parts of Torah, and they do darshan it, right? Okay, just an interesting thing is the Reform movement is moving back to ritual now. A lot more ritualistic now than they were. Okay? So, but that's just a reform of reform. They were constantly reforming. Not doing too much conserving anywhere in any movement that's not orthodox. But orthodox just means I have true doctrine. I believe this is doctrinal. Right? Okay, so that is that's really what the Acharonim try to do. The Meshech Chochma and the Tzir are just amazing at taking what Chazal say about a particular thing and showing how even though the Gemara didn't derive it from this particular thing, but I will. Not that I'm better than the Gemara, but the Gemara could have done this, but I will. Right? It's Gemara Bava Basra that says that you can't leave Israel in the time of famine unless wheat sells for such and such a price. Then things are too expensive, you might come to harm. You can leave Israel for that. The Meshech Chochma ingeniously derives this from how Yaakov leaves Israel to go down to Egypt to meet Yosef. He gets the exact measure, he gets the exact amount, it's ingenious. Right? These guys that maybe just came naturally to them because they had all of the Gemara in their head at the same time. I don't know, but this is what these Acharonim do. So remember what caused the foray into Pshat, which was influenced from Christian exposure, now influenced from Reform exposure, caused the Jews to do as they did. Okay, so I'm going to stick to the tendons now and take one of these. Okay, probably be a good exercise for you. I'm not going to ask you to hand.